This program does not create an attorney-client relationship between Moss and Barnett, a professional association, or any attorney appearing on this program and any caller or listener. Please remember that we can only give general information, and every case is unique. Always check with your individual attorney for any specific legal concerns. If you are in need of specific legal advice or are looking for an attorney, please do not hesitate to give Moss and Barnett a call at 612-877-5000.
This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
What a lovely Saturday in May. We haven't had a lot of those lately. We hope you're out enjoying it, and we hope you'll enjoy Minnesota Law today. We have a great program lined up. Tom Schroyer is in studio, and it's about the three R's. No, not reading, writing, and arithmetic, but record retention requirements. Great topic, an important topic for individuals and business owners.
I must say I'm impressed with your alliteration, Steve. Good morning. It is a beautiful day here, and we have Therese West back. Hi, Therese.
Hi, Tom. How are you this morning?
Well, never finer, thank you. And Therese, of course, was on not too long ago with us. Therese is a shareholder in Moss & Barnett's litigation department and works extensively in all facets of litigation, but I must say has a real interest in intellectual or in technology issues, and that in turn has led to the development of quite a bit of knowledge, Steve, in the area of records management and records and document retention. And Therese, certainly anytime we talk about litigation these days, that's almost the first thing out of the blocks that we talk about is locking down the systems and what are we going to save and how are we going to gather it and organize and produce it.
Document retention is actually a very complicated activity for some companies to undertake, particularly, of course, document-intensive companies. Trick here is to find the balance between what's too much and what's not enough. And as you mentioned, in the litigation context, all bets are off. So there are some different rules that apply in that context that actually require or may require you to suspend your normal document retention policies.
Right. We'll come back to talking about that. But first, I wanted to talk about a rule that I learned early on, and the more I look for it, the less I see any evidence that it has ever existed, and that is the notion that everybody has to hang on to their records, whether it's check records or tax returns or credit card receipts or in business, any kind of record, for 7 years.
I'm with you on that one, Tom. That seven-year rule doesn't seem to be rooted in anything other than a conservative approach to document retention. And the idea behind that rule is to retain documents for the longest retention period that might apply to any one class of documents. For example, if an individual should keep his tax returns for 3 years, should keep other information for 1 year, should keep other records for 6 years or 7 years, keeping everything for 7 years sort of covers the bases. For most individuals, that may be sufficient, but of course, there are exceptions to document retention beyond, say, the 3-year rule or the 7-year rule. Also, for, as I mentioned, for individuals and businesses that deal with a lot of documents, it can be quite expensive and burdensome to keep documents longer than necessary. Just from a resource management aspect, it's important to have a document retention policy that really works for the company in terms of what the company can absorb, expense, storage, space, and those types of issues.
Oh, absolutely. I know, for example, in our business, Steve, as a law firm, we employ upwards of 170 individuals, roughly 70 lawyers, and the amount of paperwork and records that we generate is really quite staggering. I know the storage costs for all of that, it really mounts on a monthly basis. I'm sure that's true for many, many businesses, if not all. And so we've had to take a very hard look at, you know, what do we retain and what don't we retain and for how long. And it does get to be a little bit of a challenge in terms of managing the different parameters that we have to look at, Therese.
It certainly does. There are good reasons to retain documents, of course, for individuals and businesses. The first consideration is, of course, to protect yourself and your business. You may need to prove that you filed tax returns timely. You may need to prove that you filed accurate tax returns. Records can be very important for monitoring the progress of your investments or your business, also to prove the existence of contracts, defend yourself or your business against a lawsuit, recover on a product defect or a warranty claim. There are all kinds of reasons why documents are critically important. The second consideration is that depending on the circumstances, there may be a legal obligation for you to retain certain documents.
Well, precisely. And I was just going to get to that. And that is, of course, in our litigation efforts, we are always looking for that proverbial smoking gun, you know, trying to find something in the records and information that has been saved by the other side that is going to prove our case or sink their positions. But I must say, if the party hadn't saved the information, then there'd be no smoking gun to look for. So doesn't it make sense to move information off into the circular file, so to speak, and not retain it against the hope that you won't have a smoking gun show up somewhere down the road?
Document management is a risk-based enterprise. It all depends on the risk. So that's a very important factor in developing any kind of a document management program. In terms of risk, you do want to, as an individual or a business owner, evaluate the risk of what happens if I don't have proof. Can I absorb the loss? That's a very important consideration. Another consideration with respect to perhaps your legal obligations for retaining documents is that you may be subject to statutory fines or penalties for not retaining documents, for destroying documents prematurely, or for destroying documents improperly. There are some laws that have specific requirements about how to destroy certain documents that contain, for example, personally identifiable health information or financial information. And so risk is a very important aspect of any document retention program.
And I suppose we might clarify as well that we're not just talking about records retention policies and procedures or requirements for business owners or operators, but rather for people individually in everyday life as well.
Yes, definitely. Individuals have a need for a document retention program, primarily driven by tax issues for most individuals. In terms of a document retention program for a, say, honest taxpayer, there is a general rule that you should keep tax returns and other financial information for as long as you might need them. And a lot of people would say, including myself, what does that mean? Well, that typically means to keep those records until after the statute of limitations for a cause of action expires with respect to those records. So, for example, when it comes to income tax returns, you must be able to support the information that's on your income tax return. The general rule is that if you are filing a claim for a credit or a refund, after you filed returns, you've got 3 years or 2 years after the tax is paid to do that. If you owe more tax, there's a three-year period in which the IRS can come back and look to you to pay that tax, and you better have the tax returns and the supporting documents to support your case.
We have more on the way. Tom Scheuer hosting Therese West today. Record retention requirements in the spotlight. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Here on News Radio 830 WCECO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know Moss and Barnett attorneys handled the first reported products liability case in the history of Minnesota for a defective tire back in 1967?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. For more information on today's program and all our programs, feel free to go online. Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. The website again, spell it out, Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. Tom Scheuer hosting Therese West. Record retention requirements. We've learned already that 7 years is just a number.
7 years is just a number. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Lawyers like to say it depends on the circumstances. Sure. Unfortunately, people aren't always happy with that response, but it really does, and particularly in this area.
Right, and we were talking before the break about how the statute of limitations is a driver for record retention in terms of tax records, and we're going to come back to that here briefly because there are a lot of exceptions, of course, to that the rule you mentioned that your tax returns are subject to being audited by the IRS for 3 years after the date of the initial filing of the return, whenever that was. So a good rule of thumb is to keep your tax records for at least 3 years after you file the return. And that's, of course, only if you're an honest taxpayer. If you've understated your income or misstated your tax by 25% or more, or if you committed fraud, then the rules are different.
They certainly are. For example, if you understate your income or if the IRS suspects you've done that, by 25% or more, there is a 6-year statute of limitations on that kind of a claim. If you filed a fraudulent tax return or didn't file a tax return at all, the IRS can come back at you any time. Also, with respect to that just general 3-year rule, taxpayers need to be mindful of multi-year issues, for example, IRAs. It is a very good idea to keep IRA records until the account is closed, and then for the 3-year period thereafter. So
I once talked to an accountant, a CPA, who said all of these IRAs and some of the other retirement accounts, Therese, are going to pose huge issues down the road when people start to cash them in because they won't be able to prove how much they paid to get into their investments when they purchased them, 20, 30, whatever, how many decades later down the road when they're trying to figure out what their gain is.
That is a very big issue. The burden of proof or the responsibility, of course, to substantiate any items on your tax return, such as deductions for IRA transactions or basis information for investments, is basically on the taxpayer. There has been some legislation in the last several years where the burden shifted to the IRS in the event of a courtroom proceeding, but that only applies in circumstances in which the taxpayer has kept good records. So good records is a threshold issue for you when going up against the IRS.
Right, and of course, if a person is interested in keeping records because of the desirability of having them to prove a legal position in a lawsuit or a tax audit or whatever, they have to be mindful of what we're calling the statute of limitations, which is a rule that's imposed by law, usually a state statute, that says a law or a claim is barred unless it's brought by a certain end date. And, of course, the statute of limitations, that's a real can of worms on a good day.
It is a real can of worms. There are what's called tolling issues, circumstances under which perhaps a 3-year statute of limitations, 2-year statute of limitations might be extended for several years due to the circumstances. In some cases, it's a product defect that wasn't discovered until sometime later, a medical issue that a patient couldn't have known about or shouldn't have known about for several years. And then, and at that point, then that's when for example, the medical malpractice statute of limitations might start to tick off. So there are definite issues with statute of limitations that you should not try to interpret yourself without some help.
Right. Very complicated, although I think it is fair to say that, generally speaking, in the state of Minnesota, for Minnesota state law claims, the statute of limitations is, rule of thumb, most of the time, 6 years.
Yes, that's correct. Rule of thumb, most of the time. Always depends on the circumstances, but yes, that's the case.
We have a text in on the program today. By the way, you can text the program at 81807 if you have a question about record retention requirements today. Feel free to call the program as well, 651-989-9226. Toll free, 1-866-989-9226. And from the text line, how long do you recommend keeping records for someone who's died?
The records retention requirements for someone who's died are basically the same as someone who's alive. The estate has a responsibility to comply with laws about record retention if there are any that are applicable to that deceased individual. Also, certainly the IRS may come back and take a look at tax returns. And so there very much is a similar circumstance to keeping records for a person who is still alive.
Right. That Form 706, the estate and gift tax return that's filed when after somebody passes, is normally filed within the first year of death and then would have another 3 years to run for a challenge or audit by the IRS. So, you know, from date of death, you're, I think, looking conservatively at a four-year marker.
I would say so, yes. The IRS could certainly come back and audit tax returns that were filed by the deceased person before he or she died.
Does it depend on the size of the estate? I'm sure that's a factor in all of this, on how much record retention you would need. If it's a very large estate, you may need a lot more records than maybe a very modest estate.
It does depend on the size of the estate, much like it depends on the size of the business or the amount of documents that an individual handles. It's all a matter, again, of risk assessment. And can the estate bear a loss due to the failure to retain records or to retain records properly?
The whole issue of course, meeting the statute of limitations is challenging because it is so complicated and subject to so many variations that it's really not fair necessarily to base it solely on that. And we'll come back after the break and talk about some of the other parameters and measurements that people look at when they're developing records retention programs.
It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Tom Schroyer hosting Therese West today. Record retention requirements. And if you have a question, feel free to call. The number is 651-989-9226. Toll free, 1-866-989-9226. Text the studio as well. We've already had a text or two on the program. Great way to go, 81807. That's 81807. And that is powered by Home Service Plus, an offering of CenterPoint Energy. A news radio, 830-WCCO. Welcome back. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Tom Schroyer is our host, Therese West, in studio from Moss and Barnett on the topic of record retention requirements. Tom?
Thanks, Steve. Therese, we're talking about the drivers that really point the markers out for people in terms of how long and what kind of records to retain. And in addition to the statute of limitations, there are a number of other considerations.
There are considerations of what your legal obligations are to retain, manage records, and then also with respect to destroying records. So those are all very critical pieces of any document retention program. For example, employers with respect to discrimination issues are required under the Civil Rights Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act to maintain certain records concerning employment, perhaps requests for reasonable accommodations. Privacy is a huge, huge hot button. And there are a lot of laws, regulations, and rules concerning protecting, for example, individually identifiable health information from disclosure, Fair and Accurate Credit Transactions Act, or FACTA, for example, contains provisions to help reduce the potential for identity theft. That includes rather the secure disposal of credit reports. The provisions of FACTA apply to any business or any individual who uses a consumer credit report for a business purpose and requires that the party who retains the records when the time comes to destroy it does so in a manner that's reasonable and appropriate to protect privacy concerns. For paper, that might mean burning it, shredding it. With respect to electronic records, that's a whole new ballgame. I think most everybody is aware that electronic records have the fortunate or unfortunate tendency to hang around long after they're supposedly deleted. And so with respect to legal obligations in terms of destroying records, it's a real good idea to have both legal support and technical support to make sure you comply with the law.
You know, it's so important what you said about electronic records. It seems like they are just about impossible to get rid of. My goodness, email lasts forever, and it gets copied over into so many different electronic hard drives. For example, my work email is also on my smartphone that I carry around with me, and increasingly iPads and other portable laptops are also carrying that information around. It's really quite astonishing how much is out there. And, of course, you're pointing out that there are some statutes that really provide for extra protections for information that is saved, such as you mentioned health information and credit records. I know that as well, Therese, the OSHA requirements are really quite draconian for some employees.
The OSHA requirements really reflect a circumstance where there are statute of limitations and legal requirements at play that make records retention requirements quite complicated. For example, with respect to medical records for any claim or defense on a medical malpractice claim, the statute of limitations may, for example, dictate that you retain those records for 2 years. In contrast, OSHA requires employers to retain medical records for employees who have been exposed to toxic substances or harmful agents for 30 years.
My goodness.
Yeah, so there are some real stringent requirements for that. For health providers, for example, the Medicare conditions for participation may impose different record retention requirements with respect to medical records in that context.
I suppose the OSHA requirement begs the question as to whether the employer knows that there's some exposure being provided to an employee to a toxic or harmful agents.
Well, it certainly does, and I think any manufacturing plant, has probably a fairly good idea whether there's that potential because of inspections and things like that. But certainly, always there is a possibility that one may not just be aware that there is an obligation to retain records.
As our listeners are perhaps sensing, records retention projects have often proven to be quite complex undertakings for our law firm when talking about a business of any size or complexity.
Very, very complex. The goal is to get a document retention or document management policy in place that provides for an accessible, reliable, and secure method of restoring or storing, maintaining, and, of course, managing records.
And we're going to talk after the break about the importance from another aspect of keeping records and what happens when a claim is made or a party has reason to know if a claim is made and the need to preserve evidence at all costs in that context.
Yes, very critical and quite a bit of risk associated with litigation.
We'll learn more about that in a moment. Therese West in studio. Tom Schroyer is our host. Record retention requirements. It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know a team of Moss and Barnett attorneys worked on the appeal of the case that served as the basis for the motion picture, North Country?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome back. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Record retention requirements. Tom Schroyer is hosting Therese West on the program today, and we'll squeeze in a quick call before we get back on track. Jerry, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, hi, everyone. I owned a small apartment building. Actually, I owned it for 29 years, and I sold it in 2009. And I have boxes of receipts and canceled checks and whatnot. So when can I get rid of all of that stuff?
As far as the receipts and the canceled checks and those things are concerned, it really depends on what the receipts are for. If you sold the property in 2009, you want to be sure to retain records about any improvements so you can support any tax issues with respect to maybe business expenses that you had with respect to the property or, as I mentioned, improvements. anything having to do with any environmental issues that might have occurred with respect to the property. You're going to want to put those records aside. So really it depends on what category record you're dealing with. If it's just simply receipts for rent payments, things like that, you're probably pretty safe to get rid of most of that, except for, as I mentioned, to the extent necessary to support your business tax returns.
Quick follow-up. I was wondering, I deal with a large bank. It's not important which one. Is the assumption that, well, the bank's going to keep all the stuff I need. I don't really need to keep, you know, these things that show up in the mail, statements, et cetera. And I've been dealing with the same tax preparer for the last 23 years, as long as I've been married. It's safe to assume he's taking care of all of that stuff. I mean, is that one way for people, or is it typical for individuals to say, well, I've been using the same bank forever and I've been using the same tax guy forever, I'm covered?
Well, it's a matter of, again, your risk tolerance. Sure. You're relying on someone else to keep your pertinent records for you. That may be fine under circumstances in some cases. In some cases, it may not be.
I might also add quickly that increasingly professionals like accountants and lawyers are making it a policy to not keep client records beyond a certain interval. So I would suggest folks should check their engagement arrangements with their CPAs and their lawyers to see who's on first, who is responsible for keeping information and records. And, you know, particularly with mobility increasing now among professionals and firms dividing and splitting up and going away, that can be a risky approach.
As far, too, as bank records are concerned, for example, your account agreement may have a requirement in it, and almost certainly does, that you need to review your statements timely to raise any issues with respect to improper charges against your account. But the other aspect of bank records is, what if you need to go back and prove that you made an improvement to your real property? Or there's some insurance issues that are reflected on your bank statement, or perhaps you can use your bank statements to prove the existence of payments under a contract.
Therese, as we're talking here about the imperatives that are driving people to wonder how long to keep records and what are the consequences for not having them, is it important to have, especially for a business now, policies and procedures established in writing before things go south and there's a claim?
It's absolutely critical to do that. And as we've talked about just a little bit today, part of a good document management program is destroying documents to reduce storage costs and to manage maintenance requirements, burdensome maintenance requirements going forward. But when litigation or the threat of litigation is involved, or a government investigation is underway, or an IRS audit is underway, you better suspend any document retention policies. And to do that, the way that we typically recommend doing that, and I think is the accepted way to do it, is that a company have what's called a litigation hold policy. When a company first becomes aware of threatened litigation or government investigation or any kind of a business dispute, those normal routines for destroying documents need to be suspended. Otherwise, the consequences could be quite severe.
And there are all kinds of rules that come into play here, and oftentimes the sanction, the penalty for destroying documents after a claim is made or a lawsuit started, is actually worse than the underlying offense.
Oh, very much so. It can rob you of the defense entirely. It can rob you of any kind of a settlement leverage in a policy. When it comes to documents, as one commentator put it, the absence of a document often says more than the existence of a document, and not in a good way. You don't want to be caught with a spoliation of evidence claim because it can be very, very devastating for you personally and for your business.
Right. It's not the crime that sends someone to jail. It's the cover-up.
Once there is a dispute threatened, the duty of any individual or business is to preserve evidence or documents related to the dispute, and to do so as long as necessary, which may be through trial and all rights of appeal, depends on the particular circumstances. That's done through, as I mentioned, issuing in the business context what's called a litigation hold. The litigation hold defines the scope of documents to be preserved, defines the duration of the litigation hold. It should also include any special instructions, for example, on how to handle emails related to the case that come in. That may be to put those in a special folder or do something like that. The key to a litigation hold is, number one, to follow it. To make absolutely sure that you not only issue that hold, but that everybody knows about it and that there's some corporate governance over it. Also, to err on the side of preservation. Again, the sanctions for spoliation of evidence can be an adverse inference at trial or monetary sanctions.
Final segment of the program coming up. Once again, record retention requirements on Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. The program comes your way each and every Saturday between 11 and noon here on News Radio 830 WCCO. Welcome back. Record retention requirements in the spotlight on Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Tom Schroyer with Therese West. I've learned a lot on the program today.
It has been a great program, one that has a lot of practical application really for everyone, not only business owners but individuals. And, Therese, as we're looking to wrap up the program quickly, can we give some folks some tips on what they should contemplate in putting together a record retention policy?
Certainly. I think that if you're dealing with any kind of volume of records at all, for example, a pretty document-intensive business, I think it's a very good idea to get on board a legal advisor and a technical advisor to help you develop a program, because they've been down that road before, and they may have some very good ideas about what you can do to implement a really effective program. I typically consider 5 steps in developing any kind of a document retention program, the first being to evaluate what my needs are and what my obligations are with respect to document retention under my particular circumstances. I also evaluate, again, my risk tolerance. Can I deal with the consequences of not maintaining an effective system of records? Then develop a program based on my needs, my obligations, and my risk tolerance, implement that program. And the 5th step, of course, is to maintain it.
And, of course, put it in writing and be sure, as you say, to follow it, because it can be a safe harbor if questions are later raised about why something was destroyed, and you can point to a written policy and say that the matter was discarded, not retained, in the ordinary course of business. And, of course, I'm sure for any business of any moment, you'd want to have in there as well a policy for how long to, and what kind of protocols to follow to back up on the server and email.
Exactly. The critical piece there is to evaluate what the circumstances are. If there's no litigation pending, if there's no business dispute threatened, and you delete documents, you should be okay.
Hours gone quickly. Therese West, Tom Schroyer, record retention requirements. Big shout out. We had a group of students in studio back on March 10th. Susan Rode hosted Judge Peter Cahill, and we learned about the Minnesota State Mock Trial Program, and some students from Breck were in. They went down to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and took 3rd in the national mock trial competition. So congrats to all those young people from Breck. And you can learn more about that program online at Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. Tom, what have we got coming up next week?
The always popular chair of Moss and Barnett's litigation department, Kurt Smith, will be on hand to talk about indemnity, program or a legal principle that applies to everyone.
Very good. Thanks again, Tom. Enjoy the day. It is a lovely day. We haven't had a nice Saturday like this in a long, long time. Friendly reminder, Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett each and every Saturday between 11 and noon. For more information on today's program and all our other programs, including podcasts, it is Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. Spell it out. We'll talk to you next Saturday at 11 on 830 WCCO.